Again, as we said, Mary's going to be speaking on step one, which is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Mary, we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. How nice to see everyone. We open with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. And I love that set-aside prayer. That's very special. I have begun to integrate it. Whenever I'm working on something, or going to pick up the phone, or working with challenging situations, it has become a comfortable prayer to pick up, even in let me just set aside my own thoughts, God. That's how quick it can be for me. So, my name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 2nd, 1997. My home group is, used to be, for many years, AM Sober. I was a regular. I loved it. It was my, I called it the MASH meeting. You laughed and you cried. But since life's a little different these days, my home group is the Lovely Ladies, Friday night, 7:30. If you haven't been, please come and join us. Ladies only, sorry, gentlemen. sorry, Kev. very powerful. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know what? I'm going to time myself because I could get a little carried away, and I don't want to do that. Good. And you know what? I say yay to that. We admitted we're powerless. Wow, what a great place to be in. And for anybody who's brand new, it's a scary place to be in. But for anybody who's been here long enough, it's a place of comfort to be able to admit that. And what a challenge I had in the beginning. I had virtually no higher power. And what I did have was somebody else's higher power, someone else's version of the God of their understanding. And the we, I struggled so greatly with the we. It was foreign to me. I felt like I was very much alone in my life from a very young age, that I was an independent entity, and I was needing to always buck up and do the right thing. I struggled with accepting help in any way, shape, or form from anyone early on, because I thought that made me less than. It made me not able to understand. It made me like I wasn't good enough or smart enough to know the answers. And I fought that. I fought it vigorously. I remember as just a young child, you know, the pushing ahead, because I was always going to be in the beginning of things. And it wasn't always in my own best interest to be like that. I know that that attitude was led by a whole lot of fear, and fear at a very young age. And I don't know where it came from. I had a loving family. But that fear was the basis for that arrogance and ego that I carried with me for a very long time. Cutting to the chase, a bit of background. My addiction kicked into gear when I was only 10 years old. I was way too young. But as I absolutely honor this program as being a program based on addiction to alcohol, I do believe a drug is a drink is a drug. Because this alcoholic tried it all during my foray. And nonetheless, at 10, I was way, way immature. But I really believed that I had found the solution to my inferior problems that I had with me. And I was in nirvana. I remember thinking, okay, life can just go on now. I'm okay. And I was young. I mean, and I wasn't even in my own safe place. I wasn't home. I was visiting relatives, which was a really unusual place. But I got swept up, to say the least. I definitely have an allergy of the body that produces an incredible phenomenon of craving. And what's an allergy but an abnormal reaction to a substance? And I take a drink, and the drink takes me, and that describes us. I dabbled in a whole lot of different stews on and off for a number of years, and you know, nobody knew it. Nobody knew that it caused trauma in me, that I was frightened. It increased my fear. It increased my aloneness. It increased my isolation from people. What I didn't understand was that when I was not under the influence of something, that I was a different person. I was moody. I was hostile. I was depressed. And now, as I know it, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, not comfortable in my own skin. And I wondered often why I couldn't party or drink like others occasionally. I always wanted it. I always craved it. I was sure that I would be all right if I had it, that justification. And what was wrong with me? Well, it was wonderful to come into this program and read the big book, especially doctor's opinion. I found myself so many places in that wonderful 164 pages. Over and over and over again, there were visions of me trying to stop, wanting to stop, trying to be different. In the doctor's opinion, the doctor Silkworth suggests that an alcoholic has a defective body. 1 out of 10 of us has this problem, and when we start drinking, we can't stop. So, onto the solutions that I live today. In these 9 weeks that I'm gonna share with you on Thursday nights, we're gonna do a deep dive into the virtues, the spiritual virtues based on the 12 steps that I endeavor to live day by day. As a result of gaining faith, of using my sponsorship, and the careful study of these 12 steps, as a way to live and to learn how to be happy without me running away from Mary. I was very good at that. Of course, Bill W. considered every step to be a spiritual principle in and of itself. And in the 12 and 12, he outlined those spiritual principles behind each step. Some of them sound like great common sense, but the strength and the fortitude and the perseverance of living them and practicing them demands far more than you initially read. So the spiritual step of a spiritual virtue of step one, honesty. And some definitions: adherence to the facts, sincerity, fairness and straightforwardness of conduct. I gotta laugh at that. Absence of lying, cheating. Well, I could say yes to all of them. At having countered all of them over and over again. While I was in college, in high school, I got affiliated in my junior year. I was dating a frat boy down at Gannon. And I got affiliated with that fraternity, and they had an open bar in the basement. That's part of the reason. And they had great gatherings, and I was pretty gaga for this guy. I got swept off my feet by this blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy who I was sure was into me as much as I wanted to be into him. And so I started, they actually started a Little Sisters through that fraternity, and I had this friend there. His real name was David, but everybody called him Stanley. And Stanley was kind of like my protector. He kind of watched out, and I didn't know how much I needed that protection. But I was there for a number of years, and I remember he called and said, let's meet for coffee. And when we met, he told me that he was very concerned that I had been coming around for quite a while. I knew all the guys. I was helping with this sorority that was a part of this fraternity or this girls group, whatever it was. And he says, but one of the problems is, he says, you come in to these functions that we have and you're dressed to the nines, and I always was. My mother took it very seriously. She had been a member of a sorority in the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and to her it was a big deal. And so I had these magnificent dresses made for me through a seamstress, oodles of them, for all these functions, all the independent dances, all the dances that Gannon has. And Stanley says, you come in and you'll look so wonderful. And he says, and as the night goes on, he says, you get meaner and you get louder and you, like, become someone else. And he says, and what's even worse is you crawl out of the basement at the frat house on your hands and knees because you're too drunk to walk. And he says, and I can't tell you how many times I've tried to help you. And he says, and you pushed me away. I was shocked at this. I really was surprised to hear this. Did I know that I'd had some problems? Yeah, but I didn't know it had caused somebody grief. I remember that I severed our relationship right there. I continued to go to the parties, but I had very little to do with Stanley. And I know how hurt he was by that. Later on in my 30s, I'm married, I've got three kids, and this dear friend of the family's comes to visit. His name is Doug. And I picked him up at the airport, and I took him to my family's home. And I met up with him a few times during the week that he was there, and I shared my children with him, and we had meals, and I ended up taking him back to the airport, and on the way there, he confronted me and said, you have so not been present for this whole week that I've been with you. I remember being taken aback because I couldn't imagine that somebody had actually noticed that I wasn't present. Because nobody other than Stanley from way back when had even talked to me about it. I really admired this man. I trusted him. I knew that he cared about me. But I looked him dead in the eye and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any problem. I've been here. You've seen me. I remember his knowing smile and his hug nonetheless. I didn't have a chance to cross him off my list because he kept showing up in my life. Well, as you can know, that my life from the age of 10 to 37 was anything but those descriptions of honesty. Not to my husband, not to my dear friends, not to any other family members, definitely not to myself. But I truly didn't know that. It was like there was a wall in front of me, a tall wall, higher than me. And I was on this side of it, and I had things that are going on. And the person I wanted to be was on the other side. I knew that she was there, but I couldn't reach her. I couldn't get to her. I didn't know why, but I couldn't. So I was introduced to this program 2 years before I actually stayed here. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I attended a few 90 and 90s within that 2 years. But I'd end up at the bottom of something, a bottle, whatever. And again, I was only half there for those couple of years. I was around the program, as we say. I didn't know that. I genuinely didn't know it. I remember apologizing to my sponsor at the time about just being around the program after I'd reintroduced for the last time. And she told me she hadn't given up on me because she really did believe that I was sincere and that I wanted sobriety and that I wanted to not continue to go out and that I wanted to be in this program and not just around it. But again, that level of honesty, it was the difference from one side of the wall to the other. Also within that step one is the concept of powerlessness. Another great description of me. Powerlessness, the quality of lacking strength or power. Helpless and totally ineffectual. Being weak and feeble. Here I was at 37, mother of three. My youngest was a year and a half. And I was a mess. So before I admitted absolute powerlessness, I got to a point, of course, that I really just wanted to be dead. My family thought it was better that I was sent away for a while. And I remember that little 1.5-year-old, he didn't have a clue what happened. Why did I go away? I don't even think he was 1.5. I remembered that I talked to him on the phone. He was a lost little soul when I left. But they sent me away to a place down in the Ozark Mountains. And it was beautiful. It wasn't a detox. It wasn't a treatment center. It was a spiritual space. And I remember walking in the woods and just wishing that I could be the squirrel that I saw up in the tree. Stupid? But no, it's how little I wanted to participate in my life. I just wanted to be relegated to gathering nuts for the winter. I know, but that's all I wanted. And I probably would have been a sober squirrel. That was one good thing. I hadn't thought about that. From that powerlessness that I felt, and the weakness, I would, with humility, find a whole brand new way of living. All my old coping mechanisms of human willpower couldn't break that mental obsession of that I, me, myself. That I couldn't fix this problem. I could do a lot for other people, but I couldn't fix me. Or as the big book schools us, lack of power is my dilemma. My inner resources, as marshaled by my will, were not sufficient. So what did I gain from being around the program for those 2 years? Well, a hefty dose of humility. Humility, freedom from pride or arrogance. Wasn't total freedom, though. I'd always believed that to think on my own volition was my own self-will. That was my job. And my responsibility of how you grow into adulthood. My father was a prominent attorney who'd come from very little on Erie's East Side in Marvintown. And I'd heard many a story at how he had survived and worked his way through at the old A&P and how hard life was. But he rose to great prominence. And he put himself through school. And I just believed that that was what I had to do. I had to find a way to be able to take care of myself. And I wasn't going to let something like this problem that I continually had with alcohol get in my way. But I'd come to a crossroads. Was I going to live or die? And dying seemed pretty easy. It would have been a long, slow death, probably, unless I had the nerve, which I never had, to do something about it. But living, how was I going to do that? And I now know that That's when my higher power stepped in. And boy, doesn't he have an incredible way of getting our attention. The 3 months before my ultimate surrender, I was verbally and physically attacked out of nowhere by someone that I loved and admired and cared about. I was beat up. I had a chipped rib. I had chest bruising. I had marks on my neck where he tried to throttle me. Well, he was very aghast at this, and he couldn't believe he had done this. He was just mad. He was mad, all right. But in classic codependent behavior, of which I've always had a problem with, I admitted that I probably deserved that attack, and that I wasn't going to say anything to anybody about it. It was going to be something that we had between the two of us. Ah, you can imagine. The resentment that escalated was overwhelming. The longer I held that secret, the more my mental state digressed. And as you heard, my sobriety date was directly after the holidays, January 2nd. And with a mixture of alcohol and a lot of toxic family in town, I hit the bottom. I couldn't hide anymore. I was broken and desperate. I called my sponsor, who I had relegated to the shelf for that 4 months before this, when that attack had happened. I didn't tell even her. Didn't tell my husband. Didn't tell nobody. It was between him and I. I pleaded with her to come and take me to Hammett Mental Health. That's the only place I belong. I'm losing my marbles. And she came, she talked to my husband, and she went the opposite direction of the hospital. And she took me to a meeting. And I was so numb, all of me, brain, body, senses. But when I walked into that room, and I heard these readings, and I saw people that I knew I was home. I knew I was safe. And I was safe from me, which was finally, the feelings that I'd been wanting to have. So what have I found to be the benefits of remaining honest, powerless, and humble? Many. I've become curious. I'm teachable. I can ask questions without feeling stupid or that I have to know it all. I have as much support and need as I want and I need when things aren't going well. And instead of bending my mind and searching through my catacombs of ideas of how I can solve a problem, I check in first with my higher power and then with my sponsor. It works. It's miraculous. I freely admit when I'm having feelings and personal problems, and when I'm overwhelmed, when I'm sad, I'm mad, I'm let down, I'm disrespected. I know how to find my part in all of that today from working the steps. I no longer have to keep those secrets or be an incredible brainiac. Oh, I remember starting to write down my lies at one point in my addiction so I could keep track of who I had said what to, because that story might have changed to another person. Insanity? You bet. I no longer have to police myself about how or when I use or with whom, and I'm truthful with myself and my higher power because I know that there's no way for me to use or drink today. That door has been bolted shut by the grace of God. I'm no longer waste time reminiscing about, oh, but I was able to do this back when, or oh, we had a great party, and oh, I wish I could be back there because I didn't get so drunk that time. No, I didn't have to worry about wondering what it was like because most of it was not good. Today I live honestly, admitting where I make mistakes without regret or abuse to myself, and I'm able to admit what needs to change in my choices and actions. I live fully in this we of this program. And I've been reminded that it's an important word. It's the most important word of all the steps. We. How lucky are we? The first one, and it's truly incorporated in all the others. Today, my words and my actions match. Only honesty, that wonderful core virtue of step one that brought me here and has given me peace and mind and body and soul. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, Mary. So now we have time for questions from our audience. So if there's anybody here in the room who has a question for Mary, go ahead and raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone. Or if you're on Zoom, just go ahead and speak up when you get the opportunity and ask your question.
Mary, when did you realize and how did you realize that you were powerless over not just alcohol and drugs, but just about everything?
Good question, Paige. Well, the surrender to the physical substances, those things that I had that craving to, that was easier than admitting my powerlessness with people, places, and things. That has been a struggle that I've had. And in hindsight, I've been in Al-Anon, our beloved other program, longer than I've even been here. I've always thought it was because of my eldest daughter, but it's because I needed sanity in one way or another. And work in the program of Al-Anon has taught me how to stay in my own hula hoop. Being powerless over drugs and alcohol was a lot easier than the daily challenge of people, places, and things. I still fall. I still catch myself wanting to buy into it and jumping out of my own little hula hoop. I've worked at keeping my hula hoop a little smaller than a regular size one, because other people can fit in the other regular size one. I can't do that anymore. So.
Who else has a question for Mary?
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for sharing on the first step. And I guess I want to follow up a little further on this, the codependency aspect. I have to wonder, did this play into your drinking as well? Is this among the things that, you know, you medicated through the booze?
Oh, no doubt, Leslie. Codependency, that also tied directly into my people-pleasing, my wanting approval, needing approval, doing anything for it. Was I off breaking the rules? Yeah. Was I doing things that I wasn't being honest with myself or anyone else about? Yes. But I always wanted people to like me and to choose me for their team. You know, that feeling of inclusiveness. So I have to say that codependency has again been something that is a constant to work on. You know, I wouldn't drink over it today, but I certainly pray over codependency a lot. It's something that I believe that I will always work on, because I'm always catching myself, asking myself, what are your motivations? Why are you doing or saying or being a certain way? Why? And that goes directly into the codependency.
Thanks. My name's Trevor, I'm a call.
Hi, Trevor.
Mary, thanks so much. Really great to hear you share your story, and I'm glad that you came back, because then we get to hear you after all these years. So, wonderful, wonderful message. My question is, I actually have two questions, and the first one's pretty quick. And then I have a follow-up. So I'll just ask the first question, which is, one, when you came back and you, your sponsor brought you to the meeting, did you stay, did you continue with that sponsor? Mm-hmm. And secondly, did you and your sponsor at that point have some particular process that you used to formalize going through this first step? In other words, is there something you could point to in your going through the steps and said, okay, I'm here on step one, I'm continuing now on to step two, and thus being able to pass it on to people you sponsor? Thank you.
Thanks, Trevor. Yes, I stayed with that sponsor. I'm going to say that she and I were together another 4 or 5 years. She ended up leaving town, and that's the only reason that I let her go. You know, I told you that I had already begun the steps. I had already done the steps fully, all the way through, or so I thought. And then I actually came in and stayed in. And I remember that she asked me, what is different? And I just remember my response had something to do with the level of desperation. Something had clicked. Something felt different. And we began step one. That we had done it the same way, read the big book, talked about it, I wrote about it, and I was able to go on. And I've often in shares wished that I had that ding, it happened point. But it wasn't like that. Other than my surrender that night, I can't tell you that what was different or what had changed, other than I've just stayed. It's been so good. You get food. You get candy. Come on. Hope that answers
Thanks
you.
So much.
You're welcome.
Who else has a question?
Carolyn, alcoholic. Well, Mary, so good to hear you and hear your story. And this is kind of fact finding. I was just wondering, I really related to several of the things that you said, particularly about being that drive for self-sufficiency, kind of, you know, do it myself, appear like I know all the answers, you know, and being full of fear. And I think, you know, I drank because I was alcoholic, but that fear now was abated temporarily by drinking. And I, the last 5 years of my drinking, I drank every day. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about your patterns of drinking and if that fear was abated for a little while or not. Thanks.
Thanks, Carolyn. Yeah, whenever I did drink, I got mighty powerful. Mighty powerful. As Stanley's description of me said. And of course, the fear was abated. But then comes the hangover. Then comes the regret. And I always jumped back into, now what do I do? Now how am I going to be? It's interesting because where my drugs let off, and my alcohol kicked in was mostly in college. I was in theater communication arts. And so I was able to hide behind a lot of acting in hiding the feelings of the fear. The fear was, I just swear I was born with it. And there's absolutely no reason. I came into a loving, compassionate family, not to say that there weren't situations around it, but I there was never abuse. There was never anything that, you know, that some people have so prevalently in their lives that says why they have the fear. But that fear of not being okay and not being enough was slightly abated, but not for very long. And you can tell I was a lousy drunk. I really was not a, I don't know if there's ever a pretty drunk, but I was far from that because there was never enough. And I remember trying to change drinks. Yeah, that was not successful. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, Gretchen Alcoholic.
Hi Gretchen.
Hi Mary. You did a great job. Thank you so much. My question is, I'm going to be like Trevor, I'm going to do a twofold here. So you started out talking about, in step one, the we. And you also mentioned about the age of your children. At least your son and your girls were a little bit older, but not by much. So how was it that in going through the we of the program, what did you find with regard to having younger children at the time, placing your sobriety and the we of the program that was necessary to continue to do the work? How did that work in your life?
Good question. That little guy of mine, like I said, how old he was, we trekked off to AM Sober every morning, Monday through Friday. He had friends there. He had friends there. And I remember that I would gather toys and stuff them into a bag, and we'd be in that big room, and anybody who remembers Harry H., Harry would get hold of the bag of toys and take Nicholas off to the corner. And there were some times that I had not interviewed some of those toys, and they were obnoxious. So I remember getting up and taking them out of the bag, so that was not play toys. My girls seem to have been oblivious, but boy, do I remember the rage that I went through. I would get into these cleaning things, you know, it had to be this way and it had to be clean and why isn't the room? And I remember putting their dolls and their toys and their clothes into black plastic bags and throwing them out in the front yard in such a rage. I still can see my middle daughter's terrified, sad face. My oldest is just like me. She's one of us. She just doesn't know it. She's not willing to admit it. I know I'm not supposed to take her inventory, but I gotta kind of live with her and pick up after her and her kid. So I am taking her inventory. She doesn't remember my rages. I find that interesting because she was a year and a half older than the middle one. And you know what? I just went to meetings. I have, my mother helped raise my children, thank God, because I was, even though I was in recovery, I was still not emotionally I was physically there, but I was not emotionally or spiritually there with them. I went through all the things that I needed to do. I fed them, I kept them clean, I cleaned the house, I had animals, I did all that, but I wasn't really, until I got well integrated into this program, those 2 years that I was around were hell for everyone. And even after I was here, my little guy, he must have been 4 and a half, 5, and I remember I was having some sort of a temper tantrum, and he said, "Mom, I think we should go to a meeting." What a dose of reality, truly, out of the mouth of babes. And I said, "Well, it's nighttime, and that there's no meetings for you to be able to go to, and we'll go tomorrow morning." And yet there were times that, thank God, between my husband and my mother, I walked out on my kids and to participate in this program because I had to. I knew that if I stayed in situations at the home that I was triggered, that I was going to be emotionally overwrought, and I knew well that I couldn't afford to be that way. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, Eric, alcoholic. Thank you. It was like me standing up there, everything you described. Kind of piggyback off of Gretchen's question, and I don't know if it necessarily has anything to do with step one, but on the kids' end of things, I also have three, all girls. They ask questions a lot, like, hey, why does Daddy go to meetings a couple of days a week? Can you explain how you kind of explain to them what the meetings were all about, like in a kid sense that they would understand it, or just some like advice on how to explain that?
Certainly. Thanks, Eric. Yeah, my kids understood that I had a group of friends, and some of them they knew and a lot of them they didn't know. And those friends helped me get and stay happy. It was a peaceful place for me to go and be with those friends. The older they got, I got a little bit more into that God helped us all be together, and that that they could decide. I tried to implement, because the God that I'd grown up with was shoved down my throat, and I didn't want that to happen to them. And so I remember the God of their understanding to be able to explain that to them. Older. When I got here, and stayed here, my oldest was 7, and then the other one was 6. And then, even older than that, 9 and 8. So they were old enough to understand. And Mommy's quite a force, and so when Mommy leaves and she's upset and she comes home in a better space, that in itself is quite an indicator that I was going to a good place and that I had good friends.
Mine are 8, 6, and 2, so the older two start in the... Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And that we come here to get well and stay well. Thanks, Eric.
Does anybody on Zoom have a question? How about in the room here? Who else has a question for Mary? Kevin does.
Of course you
do. Of course I do. Thanks, Mayor. Thanks for coming out. Nice job. My question, we were talking about, you know, when you were first in here and around, my question is, you hear it said a lot, well, I'm in the program, I'm around the program. When did that transition for you or realization come to you when you went from, yeah, I go to meetings, I'm in this, I do this, I do all this stuff, to where you became a part of you and you were in the program versus around the program?
Well, that happened on January 1st of 1997. The family was all there, and the person who had beat me up was there, and everyone was talking around situations about me, and I was in the kitchen guzzling wine. They were expecting a meal. Nobody got fed. I only have vague remembrances of that night, but I told off probably 4 members in my living room at different times and in between drinks. And after that, you know, I knew the next day I couldn't do this. I could not do this. And, you know, that was the end of that scouting around for those 2 years. There was a lot of shame for me each time I had to come back in and reintroduce. And I did. I kept coming back in. I believed that the solution was here. I believed that you had the answers, that you had a way of living that I was desperate to integrate and to stay with. And so I just kept coming back. And that day, January 2nd, was a turnaround. Well, There's other stories about January 2nd. It started with that little kid who's walking around in bare feet, and he drops a snow thing, the glass balls that have the snow in it. He drops it on one of the girls' bedroom floors, and he walks through the glass. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I got this hangover that's as big as a room. Are you kidding me? It was over the top. Then I went down into the basement, because that's where I hid out, and I found one of the guinea pigs dead. And I know that's pretty minor, but Fiona was one of the family favorites. And I don't know whether because of my negligence or because she died of old age, but she was pretty hard in that cage. And what was I going to do with this? First, I got to tell the kids. Then I got to do something with this dead body. I was over the top. I was more than insane. And that's when I called my sponsor and made the date with her to go to Hammett Mental Health. And she put me off until, I don't know, 6 o'clock that night. And I said to my brother, I said to my mother, take these kids, I can't handle it. My brother comes, I can't even talk to him. I'm just repulsed. I just can't deal with him. And so off my kids go to my mother's. Well, I spent the rest of the day making a shoebox coffin for the guinea pig. It made sense. It was the only thing I was capable of doing. But that's why when I walked into that meeting that night, I was willing to totally acknowledge my powerlessness and absolute unmanageability, because I was over the top. I was insane. That's why. Hammett Mental Health. No, not a meeting. Not a meeting. Yes, a meeting. So that's when that something shifted, and I never went back again. Well, at least just for today.
I think that does it, Mary.
We need to get rid of it.